You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for March 15th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the Vatican's hottest club, a testicle for Leibowitz, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Testicle for Annie Leibovitz?
No, no,
or is
no.
that some other person?
That is me being so sort of bank shot obscure.
Yeah.
Vis-a-vis science fiction.
Yeah, but why a testicle in, well, because that's all they have in the Vatican.
Exactly.
It?
Well, there's the big gay bathhouse that apparently
yes, several there people is.
Over. There's a massive gay scandal.
Yes, there is.
You have to throw in Stefan, since we love Stefan. And the only truly Catholic-based science fiction novel I know is called A Canticle for Leibowitz, which it has lessons for us all, Blue Gal. So everybody go out there, get a copy of it, read it up. It's a really good book, but we're saving up the science fiction portion of our show
for the end. Time. Yeah, the music we're going to do after the show's over and we've played our little music out, we are having Stump the Chump after that.
Yes, we are.
So. You don't.
But I thought I get everyone.
If science fiction is not your thing,
that's right. You could just blow right past it.
Blow right past it and just stop listening.
But I thought I'd get a really fast reference in early, because the first letter. I want everyone drinking right off the bat.
Yes, because you the really first need them to be.
The first
we got
subject,
some hate mail this week.
We get
hate mail every once in a while.
We do. We get a lot of hate mail actually.
And
we get a lot of people commenting on our blogs occasionally. And again, my rule. Is just if you're not violently overthrowing the U.S. government or advocating that or hurting someone or killing someone, or you're not, you know, telling me all about the Zionist international banking conspiracy or some other nut job conspiracy theory that I don't have time for, I'll publish whatever you put up there. I don't care. It's, you know, it's an open bar as far as I'm concerned. So you can go read a lot of mean, very angry, some of them very well thought out and put. I'm not saying that I'm dismissive of them.
Sometimes. Angry, so the angry comments are actually right.
Oh yeah,
and that's fantastic. But
and some of them I think are actually right on the money. We just disagree on. I think they're talking about a fantasy idealized world where I don't live.
Yeah,
and we should be taking these actions. Like we all agree, we shouldn't have war. Okay.
Well, and I think there's been some really moving emails that we've gotten from people.
Yeah.
On more than one occasion that say, you know, it really is important to start from the perspective that war is immoral. And
absolutely.
Often we forget to do that. And that's an important statement to make. Even if everyone thinks we already know that, I think that's a really important.
And gentlemen, we'll allude to this a little bit later after we're done with the angry email, who wrote me a very nice email. And it was to me, not to The Professional Left, so I won't quote him verbatim or talk about his name or anything. But it was a very well thought out letter about avoiding the Jack Bauer mindset that, you know, the extreme condition that once in a million years this might happen suddenly becomes how we think about policy.
Yeah.
And that is Dick Cheney's mindset. And I completely agree with it. And yet part is where the discussion gets interesting. So, for example, I'm not pissed at Glenn Greenwald for believing what he believes. I think, as we have said many times, we're both very glad that people like that exist in the world as prods. I profoundly resist the method of argumentation he uses of inventing two categories and only two categories. And one are people who agree with Glenn Greenwald, and the other are obot, fascist, ass-licking, authoritarian idiots. And you can only choose two. There's no third alternative anywhere. There's no nuance. There's no subtlety. There's no discussion. You can either be with me or you're an obot who's a moron.
Well, and that's an attorney's way of arguing, and he is an attorney, so that's
how,
what he does.
Yeah, that's how activists are.
It's professional training that leads him to do that. So, but let's get to this email, because you wanted to read. I went back and forth as to whether we should read this on the air or not, but you've won me over, Driftglass. You're forcing me against my will to read.
Well, this was the angriest and the funniest.
We both got a really good laugh out of this one, but go ahead. Why don't you read it, Driftglass?
Will. And for God's sakes, woman, don't interrupt me while I'm... Okay? All right.
I might interrupt you.
No. I will simply talk over you as I do. Here is the email in its entirety without any attribution.
Without any editing, yes.
And I'm not going to put anyone's name out there, but this came in over the transom and it was addressed to both of us.
Yes, it was.
I'll do it as, I don't know, Orson Welles and the War of the Worlds broadcast. Today is March 6, 2013, and today, after listening to most of your podcasts for March 6th, I shut it down. I doubt that I will ever listen again. I say this after having listened weekly for the last 9 months and also having sent you a small donation, for which we are very appreciative, initially thinking that your podcast was important and should not die. But now I no longer care, for I can no longer tolerate Driftglass and his obvious inability to allow his wife to finish a thought before interrupting and turning the dialogue into a never-ending monologue. It's bad enough that he repeats the same few notions week after week. I think he meant week after week. It says week and week, but what are you going to do? How he worked for large organizations, had enormous responsibility, and knows all about bureaucracy. How the dominant media is maintaining that both sides do it, act as enablers for the destructive GOP. That no matter the issue, concept, or situation under discussion, some science fiction writers already had the occasion to use it as a substrate. And by the way, bonus for using that correctly, for their tale. All interesting the first few times you've heard it, but not the 100th. But this is not the worst. The man simply never, ever shuts up. In my mind's eye, I can see him sitting there, mouth agape, while Blue Gal speaks her few short sentences, watching, waiting for her to inhale so that he can, in this nanosecond of silence, jump in, grab the microphone, and never surrender it. No doubt Driftglass thinks that what he has to say is fresh, interesting, and that we desperately need to hear it, despite the fact that we've heard it 100 times already. No doubt he is of this opinion. Yes, he's right inside my head, people. But what he should be thinking is that I'm a bore, and a rude bore at that, and that it is past time that I shut up and allow my wife to express herself. New paragraph. I predict this marriage will last no more than 9 months. If Blue Gal was subservient or slow-witted, she perhaps would hang on as slow-witted, subservient wives tend to do when married to egomaniacs.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, hush up, Blue Gal. One more sentence to go. But Blue Gal is neither subservient nor slow-witted. Too bad. All right. I will permit you a couple of seconds.
You're going to allow me a couple of seconds?
Yeah. Yeah, it's your wifely duty
to respond
first of all,
to this guy.
You should first leap to my defense, because you know. Anyway, that was the letter.
Well, here's what I wrote back to him. Dear George, his first name is George.
Okay.
Everyone agrees I'm nicer than Driftglass. Everyone, believe me, agrees with that.
Including me.
Smarter, probably a tie. He pays all the Mensa dues, as it's a discount when there is more than one in a family. We've been married for 19 months, and before that we dated for 36 or so. But if there's angels in heaven, I gotta tell you, we've been soulmates for longer than that. But more seriously, I probably need to edit out more Driftglass and leave more of me in. I do all the editing on the podcast, and I have, personally, me, Blue Gal, have complete editorial control of the final product. Mm-hmm. You have nothing to do with actually what the final podcast sounds like.
I would amend it only as follows.
Mm-hmm.
That for the record, we have occasionally thrown out whole segments.
Yeah, we have.
Because my sound editor told me it didn't sound right, or we sounded tired, or we were not firing on all cylinders.
It was self-indulgent, or it was not coming across the way we really intend it to, or you just went on for too long about David Brooks and I cut it all out.
You're trying to make
me cut out 15 minutes of David Brooks. I'm sorry, but I had to.
Yeah. So, but that
does
happen.
I mean, that does happen. And there are times, you know, we can, by the way, we are always recording in separate rooms. We do not see each other while we're recording. And, I have a tendency when I edit to edit just a little bit too tight. I do tend to take out pauses just so there's not a lot of dead air, although I understand there was a 14 second space of dead air in last week's podcast. I apologize for that.
That was the space where I allowed Bluegill to talk. And
that was the space where I was on the phone with the Vatican telling them Francis is the name you should use for the next pope.
Yeah.
At any rate, I said to him, you know, I have final editorial control of the final product. Thanks for your feedback and the support you've given us. We both appreciate it. I'm sorry you won't be listening in the future. Yours is the kind of letter I'll probably want to read on the air unless my egomaniac soulmate says no.
Yes, as I'm wont to do.
And I, you know, I appreciate this person wanting to jump to my defense, but really, we are very happily married. Uh-huh. And I don't feel there have been times we are able to type to each other while we're podcasting.
Yeah.
So if Driftglass is on a rant, there have been times more than once when I have typed a little text to you and said, let me talk.
Yeah.
Or I have something I want to add to this, or please let me just pause you for a minute.
Yeah. And that's
so he can kind of sum up and
transition more, because we don't see each other. It's a little bit hard to judge.
I can't do with the time thing. Yeah. You know, I can't put my hands together in the shape of a T.
And they're exactly. And which that's Bluegill's job.
Yeah.
Is to when I've gone on too long from her sound editing, and I could, you know, I suppose I could do sound editing, but she's really good at it. I mean, really, really good at it.
I'm not as good as Matt Filipovich, but I am good at it.
No, but she's really good at it. And part of it is just inside baseball that's probably no interest to anyone, but part of it is, at least a little bit, we get interrupted a lot. I mean, there are phone calls and there's the school calls and somebody forgot lunch. And by the way, we're out of time because somebody has to leave at, you know, 2 minutes from now to go pick up so-and-so or run with some errand. Right. We're squeezing these in increments.
Yeah.
Sometimes over the course of 3 days.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
we do
cutting all that
20 minutes there. Yeah.
And so the flow shifts or changes, or I don't remember exactly the pace we were setting or whatever. And the reason it sounds coherent and whole and quite good is because Bluegill does such a splendid job cutting it all together and leveling it and making it sound really neat. So,
but I appreciate that there are some listeners that want to hear more of me. And
I do
that's
too.
Fine.
Yeah. And, well,
and we can try to even it out a little bit, but I just want to give everyone a little piece of advice from my 50 years on this planet. Don't try to get inside someone else's marriage. It never works out.
No, it's furnished all funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so. And I have, I will say, and my sound editor will of course cut this out if it's, but I have on more than one occasion asked my wife to speak more. There are subjects that I think that I just want to sit back and listen to you talk about theology or talk about philosophy or talk about your views on capital punishment or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. Knitting. You mean knitting.
I do mean knitting. It's all a metaphor for knitting.
Knitting and knitting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But my wife is the one with a divinity degree from Harvard. And she's the one who can sit with someone like John Fugel saying.
Mm. Oh, yeah. That was fun.
And go back and forth on theology and in the weeds and really not just keep up, but absolutely go toe to toe and have a really interesting exchange. I love listening to stuff like that. And I would be delighted if we worked a little harder on our end to make sure that there are more topics like that for her to sink her teeth into. But
well, you know, there is a new pope.
Yes, there is.
And he's a Jesuit. Which is fascinating. Things are going to change as a result of there being a South American Jesuit in the Vatican. I can assure you that there are people in the Vatican who are not happy about this because there are going to be reforms made to how the administration and the bureaucracy in that complex work. That said, I don't worry too much about, and I don't think anyone else should worry too much about the direction of the church in terms of gay marriage and lots of other things. It's just pick your battles. Yeah. Let me put it that way. Yeah.
Well, it took, you know, 300 years to let Galileo out of the penalty box.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I said that about, there were some liberal bloggers going after Mother Teresa back when she was alive for being you know, pro-papacy and different things. And like, you're talking to an 80-year-old nun and you're going to try to convince her, you know, liberation theology is the way to go and she should be a feminist. I don't think so. You know, just pick your battle.
Well, and there's some people.
The church is losing relevance in a lot of ways, you know.
And really, they define, in a sense.
And corruption.
Yeah.
Mention the corruption, too.
Well, but if you want to have an interesting conversation around the subject of tradition, of the people who've thought very deeply about ethics and morality, you could do a lot worse than to pull up Aquinas or people like that. And those are people I studied with the Jesuits for a few semesters, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And then they kicked you out.
And then they told me, they said
they were very good to you. Actually,
they were very good to me. I had a ball. And I was old enough to really appreciate that kind of conversation and really take seriously.
Yeah.
Was
this at Loyola?
It was at Loyola for a few years, which was incredibly expensive. And I was, you know, in my 30s, and nobody was paying for my school but me. And I just and one of them finally said, "Look, you want to." There are certain things you want to do. You want to be continue your technical education, and you want to write. You're already a very, very good writer. We highly recommend that you go someplace else because you're wasting your money.
Wasting your money, yeah.
But the theological discussions I had, not about the history, you know, because I never had a class with a single Jesuit, with a single nun who was under the impression that the Bible was literally true at all. They're not that dumb.
Yeah.
But they do have an agenda.
Yeah.
And they do have a point of view. And in that environment, that point of view was fascinating to me because they wanted to talk about the Bible as literature, and the shape of a story and how the story was constructed tells you about the people who built it.
And it's
an artifact of a particular culture. And here's how
Wait a minute. Who was going to talk about theology? You're kind of talking over me now here, Driftglass. I'm just saying. I just want to repeat a tweet I wrote this week, which was I overheard on television, old, locked-in privilege, social conservative, and overwhelmingly white men. And I thought they were talking about the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
Turned out they were talking about the College of Cardinals. So same difference. I hope the Senate gets abolished.
I do.
Even before the College of Cardinals gets abolished.
Well, and that's...
There's still hope to reform the College of Cardinals. I don't think there's any hope for the U.S. Senate at this point.
Yeah.
as long as Ted Cruz is allowed to sit in that building.
As long as there's people who are willing to elect Ted Cruz.
Yeah,
And I think if you ever wanted to have a discussion about small C conservatism, the original idea that there are institutions of great antiquity that you should defend almost to a fault, because once you overthrow them, the chaos that follows is not worth the price of the oppression that institution may or may not have visited.
Yeah.
This is essentially David Brooks's point of view about everything.
You're not supposed to talk about his
I'm sorry.
Event.
I'm sorry. But the idea that...
Talk about Glenn Greenwald.
Well, the idea that hanging on to an institution, even though you know it's corrupt, even though is something humans just do because it's very
true.
Comforting.
That's true. Yep.
Is interesting, and codifying that in a philosophy is more or less pure dorm room conservatism, as it's understood by college students and Burke fans everywhere. It's not conservatism as it's practiced in the real world at all. It has nothing to do with the American conservative movement. It has nothing to do with the Republican Party at all, other than the institution they are seeking to protect and defend is the Confederacy. But anyway, that Catholic a little bit of Catholic education can be a good thing.
Or Jewish education. Brandeis. So
yeah, okay. You did the full Ginsburg. If you pardon
me, I did. I went from decorating a sukkah to going over to divinity school with a bunch of people.
So my wife has depths to her that are unplumbed.
Thank you.
By this podcast on a regular basis. And I would like more opportunities for her to be able to, for us to have a conversation on her turf.
I think we're turning it into tweet against theocracy.
That's a good idea.
Tat. Cause blog against theocracy is just not cutting it anymore.
No.
But, Easter weekend, we will be doing something against theocracy. And it has traditionally been Blog Against Theocracy, and I'm sure I'll have some posts up about that.
Well, on Easter weekend, I will be watching one of my favorite movies.
Ten Commandments.
The Ten Commandments.
Moses.
We're going to learn Moses' full name. Speaking of...
Speaking of which...
Commandments from on high that are...
Yeah, because David Sirota, and not to start harping on people who
are dicks,
are on our side. I have gone after David Sirota on one occasion.
Yes.
And that was the time. Generally speaking, I agree with David Sirota on most things. So yes. Let's just be clear.
Yes.
He is a good liberal. He's a good writer. He's good on up with Chris Hayes when he's on and so forth. And I certainly don't have big, huge political differences with him. But when he resigned from the blogosphere in 2009 in a big post saying, in case you've missed me, when he'd actually posted the day before, he resigned and said, I'm pretty much leaving the blogosphere and I'm going to be offline and I'm not going to be doing this anymore, except for one post here and one post here. And I'm writing a book and I'm going to China and I'm doing this and I'm doing that. Otherwise, I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. And he was... I'm sorry. All of that is fine. It's a little hypocritical. And as I said, I hope his kitchen cabinet is more gullible than I am. But the thing that really made me mad was he said that he was finding political writing uninteresting for himself. But not only that, he found most of the political writing that was out there was derivative and uninteresting.
Yes.
And he took a backhanded slap to every single blogger except for his inner circle of blogger friends.
Well, yeah, honey.
And I called him out for that. I said, we can't miss you, David Sirota, because you won't go away. So this week, David Sirota had a disagreement with Goldie Taylor. And Goldie Taylor is, you know, a former Marine, as everybody who knows her or knows about her should know.
Well, she has a long backstory. I mean,
she really does.
She's not a child of elite privilege.
Well, and
she grew up poor. Her father was murdered.
Yeah.
East St. Louis, I think,
she's a form. All you have to say about her, as far as I'm concerned, is she's a former Marine.
There are no former Marines. Huh?
Well, that's exactly right. Yeah. My point. Yeah. Yeah. She is a alumni of the Marine Corps.
She's
3 foot
nothing, tough as nails, and stole Eartha Kitt's voice. So.
Yeah, and she's fabulous. Yeah. And his tweet, is this, you typed this in here, is that a quote?
I believe it is. This was during their back and forth.
Yeah.
And it was either
nothing more distasteful than privileged U.S. elites telling everyone not to care about people we're murdering abroad.
Says David Sirota.
Said David Sirota to Goldie Taylor.
To either Goldie Taylor or when Goldie Taylor recommended or promoted or tweeted an article essentially taking Glenn Greenwald to task for being self-righteous in ways that she found distasteful. Mm-hmm. He shot back. There's nothing privileged more distasteful than privileged U.S. elites.
So he might not have been talking about Goldie Taylor. He might have been talking about the author of the article that she was promoting.
Yeah, but it was awful hard to distinguish between the two. And then they went back and forth.
Twitter. And that is to be understood.
David Sirota, who grew up on the mean streets of Hartford, Connecticut, and then went to a fairly elite charter school, and then went to Northwestern University, which ain't cheap. And has been on, and is frequently on, MSNBC, CNN, PBS, writes for Salon, been on Comedy Central, worked for Bernie Sanders, good for him, worked for AIPAC for a while, you know, has not exactly had a tough life.
And that seems to be the thing that also gets me is when he talks about, you know, I'm going to make a stronger commitment to paying work and screw all you bloggers who are doing uninteresting writing out there. And then he's going to China, and B, he's tweeting about his front row seats at the Dave Matthews. Yeah, I think he went to Dave Matthews, and he was tweeting about great seats he had at Dave Matthews concert. And all right, you know, he's got a pretty charmed life.
But it smacks a little.
Fine.
Yeah, and again, there's nothing wrong
talking about distasteful privileged U.S. elites.
Yeah.
When you write for Salon for money.
It just had this. I remember back in the day, Blue Gal. Oh, it was a long time ago. Back in the pre-YouTube days when we all blogged and.
Yeah, we did blog before YouTube. That's absolutely true.
And someone took Steve Gilliard to task for not understanding black folks. Something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And Steve Gilliard was black. Those days are almost over. I think I might be the last of the secret bloggers left out there in the world.
Yeah.
But when people found out that Digby was a woman.
Yeah.
And Steve Gilliard was black, which is what was so charming about early blogging, is the only thing you had to recommend you is your words and the diligence of your research.
Being there every day. Yeah.
And, exactly. Yeah. And your work ethic and your fidelity to facts and being able to defend your position or modify your position based on pushing and pulling and so forth. And it was a wonderful.
I still call that just posted panties for the first 2 years.
But and it worked.
It worked.
That worked too. But there was just something incredibly funny. And I have tripped over my own dick more than once. But there's a certain class of person that Mr. Sirota and Mr. Greenwald seem to fall into that cannot back off.
Yeah.
There's no off switch at all. And that is a virtuous thing when you are an activist. But I have been closely involved with activists before. And I've also been inside large bureaucracies before. And know everything
there is. Here comes this repeating theme number 3 of the Drift Glass Blue Gal podcast.
But activists, the activists I have known hate people who give them 80%, almost more than the people who give them nothing.
Zero. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're a hypocrite for not giving me 100%. You pretend you're on my side, but you won't side with me 100% and agree that everything I say is 100% correct. And you won't line up with me. Therefore, you're worse than someone who just betrays me. And it's that, Manichaean worldview that is very useful to an activist. It makes it easier for them to sleep at night because the world is divided into people who agree with me and evil monsters and the dupes of evil monsters. I don't see the world that way, which puts me at odds with people who are putatively on my side of the fence fairly often, because it's not as simple as that. There are a lot more issues at play than the very high level one. Do you think it is wrong for a president to do X?
Yeah.
Well, give me a hypothetical and I'll give you the answer, but I'm not going to answer that question in blanket terms because I don't see the world that way.
But you know what? For anyone who thinks we're being too hard on those folks, may I recommend that you go listen to the Bob and Chez show?
Yeah.
Because we listened to their, I think it was March 6th or March 7th episode about Glenn Greenwald. And they also take on David Sirota. And it's Bob Seska. And Chez is his partner in crime over there. And let me tell you, there's no sugarcoating going on. And we listened to that episode and we really enjoyed it. They're good guys. So if you think we're sugarcoating this and moving on too fast, go listen to them. If you think we're being too hard on Sirota and Greenwald, go listen to them.
Well,
and we got to move on.
And well, this gets us back to the emailer who sent me a very, very detailed, thoughtful note about
Jack Bauer thing. Yeah.
And how, if the circumstances arises where the president honestly thinks, based on secret intelligence, because you can't let people know where some of your stuff comes from. You just can't. Sorry, you just can't. That he has to do something extraordinary and outside the bounds of the law or whatever, or that's legally sketchy for the good of the country. And again, as a side note, one of the elements of crime is motive. I still haven't had a satisfactory explanation of what Barack Obama's motive is for staying up late at night plotting to kill children. I understand the Cheney Bush motive for lying us into Iraq.
Money, yeah.
Oil, money, that he tried to kill my daddy, neocon theory that says we'll go decapitate regimes and sprinkle some magic, capitalist dust and boom, Jeffersonian democracy. That's okay, I get that. But there doesn't seem to be any real financial or political or upside to what Obama's doing.
Well, I have a couple comments about that. One is, there is one motive that I think is really important to keep in mind. And at the risk of repeating myself, Rachel Maddow's book goes into it in great detail.
In
Drift. And I highly recommend that to anyone who has thought about drones and is concerned about it and disagrees with the president on drones really needs to read that book, Drift. It's important because she puts it in a long-term historical perspective of consolidating presidential executive power. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going on. And there is that motivation to keep doing that when it comes to war.
Right.
And Obama unfortunately has done nothing, as I predicted in 2007.
Yes.
Because Hillary Clinton wasn't going to do anything either. John McCain, God forbid, he wasn't going to do anything about that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was, there was not an either or choice for the voter in unless for some odd reason Dennis Kucinich got way more votes than he did. We were not going to see anyone back down from rescinding presidential power. That is something the Congress is going to have to do.
Yes.
Now, so that's very important. And that is one motivation, I think, President Obama and all the presidents before him since Lincoln, at least, have had, which is consolidate that power in the executive. And by the way, I disagree with you, Driftglass, on the comment that, well, yes, Lincoln would have used drones against American citizens on American soil. That's true.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, Lincoln also absolutely did suspend habeas corpus during the war and put Southerners in horrible prison camps and starved them and was very neglectful of civil liberties toward American citizens. And he considered them American citizens. He didn't recognize the Confederacy. So I would like to think that I would be one of the people holding that up as a mistake that Lincoln was making at the time.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have been or not.
Well, I agree with you. And
I would have been a radical Republican.
Well, but and this is someone, I'm sure I'm misquoting Sherman, but early on in the war, when people thought it was going to be a couple of fixed battles, people would take picnics to them.
By Thanksgiving. Yeah.
That kind of thinking. I think it was Sherman who said, no, we'll have to destroy the South. I know the Southerners, and we will have to burn their cities to the ground and kill their people.
The Japanese. Yeah,
and wipe them out.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. Or they'll never stop fighting. Mm-hmm. And once you've started that, mm-hmm. you can't stop it until it's over.
Right.
There's no off ramp.
Yep.
And Sherman, I wasn't saying this because, yay, let's kill a lot of people. That's a wonderful thing. I love doing that. It's like, no, you don't understand. Once you start this, the only way it'll ever be over is with their cities burned to the ground.
They're fighting for an idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, so anyway, that is simply a matter of history.
But they're fighting for an idea. But that's – so number one is go read Rachel Maddow's book and understand that one of Obama's motivations is consolidating American presidential executive power.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I forget – I was going to say.
My Jedi mind tricks to make my wife be quiet so I can get in my important points. Jack Bauer.
To me.
Jack Bauer thinking.
Yeah.
Jack Bauer thinking that the president should do what he feels is necessary and then stand trial.
Yeah.
No, he should have to defend what he did. Yes, I did this extrajudicial thing. Eisenhower flew spy planes over the Soviet Union. In illegally until one was shot down, although Robert Heinlein thinks it wasn't shot down based on the fact that he was actually in Russia with his wife at the time, the fact that a plane falling from 103,000 feet or whatever the hell it was had delicate radio
Heinlein
equipment.
Had some weird moments.
Well, the fact that they had this plane on display in Russia and that there were delicate radio equipment that was intact, which is impossible to believe that if you'd blown it out of the sky with a missile, that would be true. Anyway, that's a completely weird historical cul-de-sac that I didn't want to go down. But presidents, you know, the ideal that this reader said was, look, yeah, he should do what he feels is necessary and then stand
well, either for, stand trial in a re-election campaign or stand trial, actually stand
exactly.
trial before the Senate.
Yeah. And I what I said was, I agree with everything you just said. Mm-hmm. And again, as we've established, Blue Gal is a better person than me. So if I were the president of the United States at this time and I had the opportunity to – I'm not saying this is the way things are. I'm saying if I had the opportunity to kill bad guys by bombing them from space, I would do it in a heartbeat. Now, I would also, in an ideal world, take my case in front of Congress and say, here's what I did. Here's why I did it. I felt it was necessary at the time. We can disagree over whether or not my actions were legal, but I felt it was necessary and imperative and time critical and blah, blah, blah. That's what I think the world should look like.
Okay.
Now, here's the problem with that. Does anyone think the Republican Party can be trusted to fairly and impartially litigate that in Congress? Does anyone in their right mind who watched George H.W. Bush pardon people who were traitors because they were his friends, who watched them work diligently for 8 years to overthrow the duly elected president of the United States, who impeached him on trivia just to get rid of him, who then turned around and gave a big wet kiss and a blank check to war criminals, and then turned right back.
And then turned right back around and tried to privatize Social Security.
And tried explicitly to block every single thing Barack Obama has ever tried to do. That is the 20-year history of the Republican Party. Every time they've gotten a hold of power, they've abused it. Every time one of their criminals has been in the dock, they've pardoned them or given them a blank check. But you put a Democrat in the White House and let him do nothing relative to their crimes, and they will impeach him, given half a chance. And remember, let's as a historic footnote, remember that Ron Paul voted for impeachment, voted for all four counts of impeachment of Bill Clinton, not because he felt he was guilty of the trivial offenses for which he was charged. He thought it was poorly constructed. He thought the case was trivial. He thought the prosecutor was a partisan thug. But he felt that Bill Clinton should be impeached for firing missiles into Afghanistan and Sudan. And since the Congress wasn't going to impeach him for that, well, fuck it. They'll impeach him for something, and I'll vote for it. That is what the principled Ron Paul said during a press conference.
Well, this gets to what exactly I forgot I was going to say.
Let me cap this by saying, and people who say, you know, how can you trust Obama when you didn't trust Bush? Look, maybe people who have no memory prior to 2006 can think that, or 2007. But having watched this Republican Party pardon war criminals, excuse war crimes, and then impeach Democratic presidents for nothing.
And pardon Nixon and convince everybody that that's for the good of the country, too. I mean, watch that.
Yeah. Not only do I not trust the Republican Party to fairly and impartially litigate anything regarding the Democratic Party, I don't know who in their fucking right minds would.
Yeah.
So given the fact that the court in this case is inherently corrupt and partisan and has proven repeatedly that it will use any opportunity to overthrow the election, to undo the election of a Democrat because they don't think the Democrats are legitimate. I don't know how.
And to even go so far as to rig the Electoral College to win elections. Yeah.
And so if I'm sitting in the White House, I'm simply not going to allow Congress into this conversation at all, because I know what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And that might make me a bad person. It might make me retroactively flunk myself from my own constitutional law class. But as a practical matter, I think Republicans are the Republican Party are evil and run by very bad people. And I don't want them anywhere near the ability to make policy or shape policy or drag anyone from office who I elected just because they don't happen to like the color of his skin or his party affiliation.
Yeah.
And they'll do it. Anyway, as you were
saying. Back to what I forgot I was going to say and what I am going to say now. You talked about Clinton going before the Congress, or that Ron Paul thought that he should go before the Congress and ask for permission to go bomb Afghanistan. Yeah. And he had sent missiles into Afghanistan to go after Al-Qaeda because he had information that they wanted to hurt Americans, and you know, perhaps he could have prevented 9/11 if he'd actually put a few missiles in the right caves, and we don't know that.
According to reports afterwards, and take them for what they were.
He did say he did go after Mike Wallace and say, I tried to kill Bill.
Osama bin Laden, and missed him by a couple of hours in Afghanistan. That was what he was doing. But of course, remember at the time, Ron Paul said explicitly and declaratively, there was no doubt in his mind. The reason Bill Clinton did this was nefarious.
Yeah.
It was
to distract Americans from his affair
exactly. He didn't want people talking about Monica Lewinsky, so he was killing poor people overseas to distract Americans from the fact that he was being
wagged the dog. Yeah.
And Ron Paul went in front of a press conference and said this as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
He knew it. He knew that, first of all, he knew that these people were no threat to America. And he knew that what Bill Clinton was doing was he was only doing it for the nastiest, most vicious, most craven political motives. Therefore, it was legitimate in his mind to impeach him for bullshit that he knew was bullshit, because he should fucking well be impeached for something. That's Ron Paul. And that's, in a larger sense, that's the Republican Party. I know liberals are bad. I know Democrats are bad. And whatever, I will do whatever I have to do to unseat them and grind them into the dust, because they are simply, they're secretly communists.
And what I forgot that I was going to say
is,
and this relates to the whole Bradley Manning episode. And by the way, we want to thank the listener, the anonymous listener so far.
Yeah.
Who sent us a subscription to Rolling Stone magazine.
Yeah.
And there was I picked it up. I was taking our son to the orthodontist and picked up the P.O. Box mail. And there was this issue of Rolling Stone magazine addressed to Driftglass and Blue Gal. Thank you very much. But my son picked it up and he wanted to know if there were any girls in it. I said, no, he's 14. Not really. And he opened right up to this big long article about Bradley Manning, and he had a lot of questions for me about why do we have so many secrets.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful question, and it is turning out that the number of classified documents and classified information and things that have to go through a classification process in Washington DC and around the country on the behalf of the federal government is just growing at astronomical rates.
Yeah.
Yep. For no reason other than it allows there to be a pecking order among the bureaucracy that, well, you can't see that it's classified, but I can see it and my colleagues can see it. But, you know, and these classifications are actually pecking orders for bureaucrats rather than,
yeah,
this really needs to be secret.
In lieu of wire garbage cans versus wooden garbage cans, I can put an Umbra classification on something, and you can only put a top secret underneath.
And that's a big, huge question for the federal government, but also in terms of, you know, who do you tell in the Congress and who do you tell what to in the Congress, and going before the entire Congress in an open session and saying there's this group called Al Qaeda that we know is trying to kill Americans, and so we're going to do X, Y, and Z to stop them, is probably not what you want to do.
Yeah.
At that point when you're Clinton. But I do think that's something that is sort of under the radar of a lot of people, and yeah, it's something that probably shouldn't be.
Well, I was and since we have a little science fiction bump at the end, I did want to mention, because I assume everyone's Heinlein drink is, or Canticle for Liebowitz drink now, is dry. Let me add that I believe there's a David Brin novel, probably Earth or The Postman or something. I think it's Earth, where he posits a secrecy act where every government secret is exposed after 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And the only way to avoid this automatic exposure is through some like incredibly extraordinary court measure.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You have to prove that you will destroy the earth if you let this secret out. But the default position is after 10 years, every secret is published. And I like that idea.
And if you want to keep it a secret, you just simply have to go before the FISA court or whoever it is you're going to put in charge of that sort of thing, mm-hmm, and make a case. And you can do that, but that costs your department time and resources to do that. And yeah, I think that would be a very good
fix the government so it's not full of crazy corrupt assholes.
Yeah.
Then you can start passing,
start being reasonable about classifications and war.
Yeah.
And recognize the position. Congress needs to recognize their own position in terms of defending the country and not leave it to the executive. So
that's why they're the Article One they're the Article One branch of government. They're the first.
See?
Yeah.
In the Congress, speaking of trusting Congress to do anything right, this week was Defund Obamacare week over at the Paul Ryan, Marco Rubio funhouse.
Well, not quite defund it, but
Yeah, no, they had a vote, Driftglass.
Yeah, no, I mean,
they had a vote in the U.S. Senate. Not, they didn't have a filibuster. They didn't have a lift your finger filibuster. Uh-huh. It was an actual vote to defund Obamacare, sponsored by Ted Cruz, that failed. And to me, the fact that defund Obamacare got a vote and guns and jobs do not,
right,
is the only argument you need to abolish the Senate. That's it. Well, it's, they are so broken, and I'm not, so done.
You would not realize from listening to the news on any given day, speaking of things that don't get talked about enough,
yeah,
the Progressive Caucus has lots of good legislative ideas, including a progressive budget.
Yeah.
That
it creates jobs. Yeah. Oh, my God. And it doesn't do anything about abortion, Driftglass.
And there's even a group of people who are talking about the fact that deficits aren't large enough.
No, that was new this week. And that was very refreshing, that we don't have a debt problem in America. What we have is low interest rates, and we should take advantage of them. Now, Ezra Klein's been saying that for a while.
Yeah, a lot of people have. But
it went above the water level this week a little bit on television.
We have all this broken infrastructure. We can borrow interest and essentially borrow money at negative interest. And that's never going to happen again in history.
Yeah.
And the fact that we're not taking a massive advantage of it to
create
build
jobs
an infrastructure
and a tax base for states and local communities is crazy.
Obscene. That is a really interesting, legitimate conversation to have. But
I have another idea. We could defund Obamacare and keep the taxes.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. You defund the care part. I never believe that the people who run our country, the media, industrial, entertainment complex that run our country, ever reach a tipping point where they just gag. And they say, enough already. Enough. We're not, you know, on this one thing, we can no longer look ourselves in the mirror and continue to take you seriously because you're a fucking clown. Mm-hmm. But Paul Ryan is awfully close to coming to that point where he just is a fucking clown. And the people who have been propping him up and propping him up, pretending he's a smart guy, pretending that he's a serious
guy.
He's a numbers guy. Yeah, they're imaginary numbers. Sure. You know, the shit. But yeah, he has lots of numbers. He pulls them out of his ass every day. But the people who are still willing to say that Republicans have anything substantive to say about anything regarding the budget are getting smaller and smaller. I find that marginally encouraging. I don't think it'll change anything because I think another shiny object will come along and they'll find some more hippies to punch and then we'll be right back in the soup. But the fact that Paul Ryan got essentially pantsed on Fox News.
Yeah, yeah.
And that people...
That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Says that, Fox News.
Wait a minute.
Chris Wallace.
You're getting rid of everything about Obamacare except for the taxes that you're then going to use to prop up your crazy budget, which is going to balance the budget in 10 years, but it never actually does.
Yeah.
And all of your numbers are fantasies and asterisks and to be announced and shit that you won't tell anybody about because it's really complicated and there's math involved. And at some
point...
It's
got a nice green cover that cost how much? Yeah.
And now that you've done this like 5 times in a row, slowly people are starting to notice that whenever Paul Ryan starts talking about the budget, he's probably lying.
Yeah. It's just like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio talking about immigration reform.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have no idea where they actually stand until the day before the primary, apparently. You know, it just... And I wonder, Driftglass, I wonder who Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio are actually talking to when they say these crazy things. When they flip-flop at this early stage when no one, except for you and I and a few political nut jobs, are like us, are listening to what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's listening, and they must think that, you know, the Heritage Foundation is listening or Fox News listeners only are listening to them, or it's big fundraisers. It's a big fundraiser thing where we're going to be as far right as we can to please some right wing crackpot billionaire to get into our corner early so we can fund our campaign. But because Marco Rubio saying on Hugh Hewitt's show, I'm going to vote to shut down the government if we don't defund Obamacare. Who is he talking to?
Well,
Hugh Hewitt. Remember, I know. He's talking to Hugh Hewitt.
He's talking
That's
to Hugh Hewitt.
Talking to.
And again, there's this still this disturbing.
I still want to go on a cruise with Hugh Hewitt.
Yeah. I know you do.
Maybe
I do
someday
too.
When you're too much of a megalomaniac, I'll leave you and go on.
Maybe I'll permit you. Maybe I'll allow you to go to QQ. Yeah. I think there's still this vestigial, and in some cases quite legitimate belief on the part of especially Republican politicians. I remember when the gap between whatever you said today and your youthful indiscretion, when you did exactly the opposite, had to be at least 20 years.
Would be a long time.
Henry Hyde voting to impeach Bill Clinton for having an affair when Henry Hyde had an affair. Yeah. Well, that was when I was young. Yeah, you're 900 now. You had an affair when you're exactly the same age that Clinton is now, but you're calling it a youthful indiscretion.
Yeah.
George Bush dodging the draft. Bill Clinton smoking pot. There has to be some interval. Now it's at the beginning of the preceding paragraph.
Yeah.
It's... Oh,
it's,
ignore
it's
what
book
I said.
I just published, but you know, I wrote it last month.
But this is
my ghostwriter wrote it last month. It sounded good.
And this is going to sound horribly repetitive, Blue Gown, but I'll risk it. That I wrote a post that I've flogged to death now called "Like a Virgin," and it was about Republicans discovering
these get out of jail free cards.
Well, they discovered in 9/11 that all it takes is a catastrophe for them to be permitted to completely rewrite their personal history.
So maybe that's why they're creating all of these economic disasters.
Well,
it's because it gives them these rewrite capabilities. That's fascinating.
They've gotten addicted. They have addicted to the idea that the press, the press and centrists will permit them to completely disavow what they said a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago,
a crisis. Yeah.
And the master at that, and I have to bend my Lenten promise, is David Brooks.
Yeah.
David Brooks disavows, either through inaction or through outright lying in public, everything he wrote when he was working at the Weekly Standard.
Yeah.
And it's not trivial stuff either. It's stuff about war and peace and life and death and liberals and economics.
But that really does explain why every 3 months we have to have a manufactured crisis.
Yeah.
Because that allows them to forget everything they said 3 months ago.
Pretend it never happened.
Yeah.
And again.
And the media goes right along with that, because what we're talking about right now is the sequester. We're not talking about the shutting down the government. We're not talking. That's 3 months from now.
That's sealing up. That's entirely different. No, it's the same people pulling the same shit with a different weapon.
Yep.
And the fact and now. I believe there has to be a threshold point beyond which even David Gregory just says, I don't care how much money Northrop Grumman shoves up my ass.
Yeah.
I cannot continue to come out here and look this fucking stupid. Because every time I have John McCain on my show to lie about foreign policy and pretend he never said the shit he said the day before, every time I let four Republicans or centrists on for every weak Democrat or weak liberal, and then I tell that liberal in advance, here's all the shit you can't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even pull that shit off anymore, because I'm getting roasted on Twitter. I'm getting beaten up as a buffoon. I'm being humiliated at parties by people who say, dude, I mean, there's some shit even I won't do for money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when back alley hookers are telling you there's some shit even I won't do. I don't care how many country club memberships you have. And I don't think there's a tipping point or a threshold, because I think once you don't have a conscience and you're willing to tell yourself.
Once the money is that high too.
And once you're willing to tell yourself, I don't really care. I'm getting paid and that's all I care about. That's my morality. Then you've sort of lost your soul. But there is a point of diminishing returns when the cycle time between the lie you told and the next lie you have to tell to cover up your previous lie is so short that even lobotomized morons start to notice that there's something wrong about this picture.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we're approaching that.
I mean, it's going to get so bad that even Jay Leno is going to start to make fun of you.
It's going to get that bad.
Can you believe this guy? Look, he said something in 5 minutes. It was 5 seconds ago. Yeah.
And this actually does apply to everything we've talked about tonight and everything we talk about almost every podcast, in that nothing's going to get fixed ever until these problems get fixed, until these people cannot show their faces in public, until these people in the media are laughed off the stage, and until these people are voted out of office. Because as long as they control the levers of power and the access to the public square and the biggest megaphones, we're never going to, things will never get any better.
Yeah.
Because they won't permit them to get better. So
I think we came to a really good conclusion. I had not thought about that before, that the manufactured crises are their get out of jail free card. and it allows the media to cover something quote unquote new. And we'll interrupt it with a new pope every once in a while or an Oscar race or something like that. But then baby in a well, you know, whatever it is, there's this new thing, this new crisis. We got to.
Oh, balloon boy. Look, it's balloon.
Never became. We need a graphic for that, Wolf Blitzer.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the Situation Room. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is named Fluffy. And it's Phluffy. Fluffy.
Uh-huh.
In her internet kitty picture, Fluffy has decided to open her eyes only halfway. Open her eyes the whole way? Ain't nobody got time for that. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us, unless you want to stump Driftglass on a science fiction question, in which case you should send it just to me.
Yeah.
And I was pretty good about keeping them from you.
Oh, you were really good. Yeah. I got stumped a few times.
My email address, personal email address to me, Blue Gal, is bluegalsblog@gmail.com. And Driftglass, why don't you give out your personal email so that people can call you a sexist megalomaniac to your face?
Well, that's not to my face, but first of all, you can always come past driftglass.blogspot.com.
Yes, you can.
And go to my comment section and leave a terribly offensive comment about how awful I am. And I will, again, if you're not threatening the violent overthrow of anything and not jamming a weird conspiracy theory into my comment section, which I simply won't tolerate, I'll publish it. I'm in a really wide open bar, and I'll publish almost anything by almost anybody. But if you want to email me directly, it's driftglass99@gmail.com.
And we are on Twitter. I'm Blue Gal on Twitter, and you are Mr. MR_Electrico.
Yes, which I have gotten a lot of shit over that I should, because there's a woman out there named Haley, I forget her name, a very nice person, a gamer, really.
She's a gamer, and she's Driftglass, and that's Driftglass. She got it first. So.
And people gave me a lot of shit over, why didn't you offer her a trade, or why didn't you this and that? I said, first of all, as a liberal, I respect property rights.
Yeah.
Secondly, I didn't come into this with a business plan, you know. You have to have brand consolidation, man. You can't have like two identities. You can't have two. Yeah, I can. Because, you know, this is, again, this is not a business plan. This is what we do because we love it. We'd like to be able to monetize it to a certain degree, but not at the expense.
And we have been able to pay our electric bill and our cable bill.
Yeah.
Part of our cable bill.
Yeah.
This, so we're grateful for that. We're grateful for your support. We had some lovely letters and contributions this week in the post office box. Thank you very much. I'm behind on my letter writing by about a month, but emails I'm pretty good at, but I've got a stack of letters to write to people, and I know I do. Feel free to write us. We will get back to you eventually. Be aware. We want to say happy birthday to your mom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Driftglass Hippie Mom.
Driftglass Hippie Mom. Where am I? Oh, feel free to write us. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Union letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the internet kitties are busy saying a mass for Google Reader.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying.
Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
And it's always a pleasure podcasting with you, Blue Gal.
I love doing this.
Yeah. What's this stuff?
I love our listeners, even the ones that try to get inside our marriage.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I don't love them, but I have sympathy for that person. So.
I do. And I think his heart was in the right place.
His heart, he was trying to stand up for me, and that's very kind. Yeah.
He was.
Yeah.
And the misplaced nobility is still nobility.
It is. All right. So, Driftglass, we're going to start Stump the Chump with Petocchio.
All right.
Because Petocchio had a comment about the whole Franco Colbert thing with the Tolkien. He said that he thought that Franco's question for Colbert was pretty easy, although Colbert's delivery was fantastic. And I would imagine it was a setup anyway. I'm not sure it was a setup.
No.
But Colbert's delivery and the whole thing about, you come to my house, you come to my house with a Tolkien question, you know, that was pretty good.
Even if it was rehearsed, it was executed with such elan.
It really was.
That it really came off. And the thing is, you know that Stephen Colbert really knows that stuff.
Yeah.
To that degree of geekdom. So
oh, yeah. Well, yeah. And as I say, it seems as though Bertocchio is also a Tolkien aficionado. So he said the question was easy. It wasn't easy for me. I haven't read The Cimarron or any of those books. So I read The Hobbit when I was a teenager. That's it for me. All right. The first question Bertocchio has, and he titles his email, by the way, "I have no trivia and I must scream."
Oh, no.
You guys are really in a geek off now.
Bertocchio is I bow to his kung fu. It is superior to mine in every way. So have mercy on me, Bertocchio.
We'll see if a geek off is a good idea, Bertocchio writes. Better as a bonus podcast, methinks. And that's why we're putting this at the end. It's not for everybody. But since Driftglass loves Ellison and doesn't know comic books.
Yeah.
What is the name of the graphic novel Ellison wrote? And bonus points for the artist or any of the story names. I would guess he knows this one.
Screw me. No, because I don't follow Harlan Ellison's comic book life.
Ah.
I know. For example, okay. Let me just throw enough chaff in the air to let you know that I'm bullshitting you to try to get around the fact that I don't know the answer to the question. First of all, a graphic novel doesn't have stories in it, Bertocchio. A novel is a single story. So, you know, I have to take points off for the concept that you've misused the English language. I know that Harlan Ellison is mentioned as a character in the Flea, which I thought was really funny. You win your own free Harlan Ellison. I know that he contributed to or wrote scripts for the new Scooby-Doo.
Oh, my God.
I know that because one of the good people at Deep Shag Records sent me his CDs, and I listened to them with great pleasure. And I know that he is an extremely big fan and a great aficionado of the artists of comic books going back to the 30s, which I couldn't touch with a pike staff. I couldn't do it. And so I will confess my ignorance to this. I know that he worked for Dark Horse Comics for a while. I know he sold a collection of his stories to a graphic novel house a few years ago, whose name eludes me, but I cannot answer your question.
Okay. So you are stumped in that regard. He also apparently wrote an episode of The Outer Limits.
Oh yeah. No, he wrote two episodes of The Outer Limits.
Oh.
He wrote Demon with a Glass Hand and Soldier.
Oh, okay.
Which he later sued Jim Cameron over. It's the plot of Terminator.
It's the Terminator, yeah.
And if
Jim
Cameron hadn't said in front of witnesses, yeah, I stole this shit from
Harlan Ellison.
Yeah, I don't think he would have sued him. But yeah, no, he wrote two of them, one of which was the very, very best one, I think, of all The Outer Limits, which Robert Culp, Demon with a Glass Hand, really wonderful episode.
All right.
So, but I don't know. I can't answer your question.
The answer, apparently there are now two graphic novels or graphic publications. One is called Night and the Enemy, okay, which includes five short stories, which are illustrated. So I guess he wrote these before and then they're illustrated in these graphics.
Oh, see, no, I know the short stories.
Well, let me read the titles of the short stories to you. For the first one, it's Run for the Stars, Life Hutch, Life Hutch, The Untouchable Adolescence, Sleeping Dogs, Trojan Hearse, and that's it. All right. And then for the second group.
Let me take a pot shot that it has something, because he's redone the same thing, A Boy and His Dog. Something, A Boy, because he did a sequel to that called Bloods Are Over. So maybe Bloods Are Over.
The second one is Vic and Blood, The Continuing Adventures of a Boy and His Dog.
All right. So, okay.
All right.
50.
Beginning with Egg Sucker, A Boy and His Dog. And each adaptation is followed by the actual Ellison short story.
Okay.
So, and Vic and Blood, I guess, is published a great many different times.
Yeah.
In different Yeah. He's republished it in different formats.
Well, and a Boy and His Dog gave Don Johnson his movie career.
Yeah, the cult film. Yeah.
The first movie he ever appeared in.
Nebula winning novella. Yes. Okay. So.
Well, and this is a bit of a cheat because Harlan Ellison reprints a lot of his stories over and over and over again in different venues.
I see.
So, for example, the very, 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 very first story he ever published, to my knowledge, not the first one he ever wrote, but the first one he ever published in a major publication was called Life Hutch.
Yes.
Which is a straight up science fiction story about escaping from something using a flashlight and a robot, which was a wonderful little story. And, you know, it didn't show a whole lot of his later promise, but it was a terrific straight up science fiction story. And Run for the Stars, I think the other one was, is a short story from the 60s, I think, from his Man Kaiben War series, in which a coward is used as a weapon and redeems himself at the end. And I will tell you no.
Don't tell him. No spoilers.
But
all right.
I'm familiar with the short stories. I would have guessed. Honestly, I would have guessed. I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream.
Yeah.
But that's just me because I'm a geek that way. But you stumped me mostly, Bitocchio. I will concede the field of honor to you.
The second question is from Derek.
Hey, Derek.
I wonder if Driftglass could describe the physiology and habitat of the alien creatures known as Chela. Featured in Robert Forward's 1980 novel, Dragon's Egg.
Uh-huh.
Driftglass could really validate his hardcore sci-fi geek cred by specifically describing the size of Chela.
All right.
All right.
I actually do know this one. The Dragon's Egg is reference to the place where the Chela live. It's the surface of a neutron star, which has gravity millions of times greater than the Earth, tremendously orders of magnitude greater. It is a crushed star. It's one squeeze away from being a black hole. So as I recall, the author said, what would life be like on that surface? It would be a species governed entirely by gravity and magnetism. They would be incredibly small. Not quite microscopic, but very, very small. Their lifespan would be incredibly accelerated. You could observe, as I think happened in this novel, the entire rise of their civilization over the course of months or something like that. It's for a very brief period of time. They would have regenerative ability. As I recall, climbing a mountain on the Dragon's Egg meant you go up a rise that's, you know, a millimeter or two, just incredibly small distances. This one creature falls. We follow various generations of these creatures as they crest a mountain. Essentially, the sort of the human story spreading out of Africa. They one of them falls. Its bones break. They reheal. They're made out of the material that neutron stars are made out of, neutronium, and they develop this. They go from prehistory to advanced technological civilization very fast, like within the observation time of the people. On the Earthship watching them, to the point where they build their own starships, take off, head off to Earth to study us. And I believe they save the human race by removing some
no black... spoilers.
Well, by saving... They save the human race by doing something nice for us.
Oh, so good.
I will say nothing more than that.
Well, you are correct. And the only thing I would add to that, according to Derek, is they are sesame seed-sized.
Well, okay.
And the Chela culture develops through prehistory, Middle Ages, Renaissance, and Information Age in the matter of a few days. And while the humans are watching them, they develop a spacecraft and investigate the humans. Yes, so very good. Also, Derek wants us to read, as several other of our listeners want us to read, Terry Pratchett. So
yeah,
one of our listeners has sent me several Terry Pratchett paperbacks, and I have promised Derek and this other very generous person, that Raymond is his name, that yes, this year I will get to some Terry Pratchett. I promise. All right. And the next question is from Kevin Holsinger, who is one of our Facebook fans, and he says we can use his last name because he's on Facebook all the time.
Hey, Kevin.
And he doesn't really have a Stump the Chump question. He has more of a philosophical question for you about science fiction.
Oh, essay question. Great.
Yeah.
This is how you fail tests. Yeah.
He wants to know, and he's got three examples that he wants to share with you. He wants to know what you think the most plausible, distantly futuristic political setup you've seen in a work of science fiction. And he gives the examples of the queen in Star Wars being more than a ceremonial monarch, and it seems kind of anachronistic to him. Mm-hmm. Also, the Dune series, you have dukes and barons, which seems anachronistic. And finally, even the title emperor, which Palpatine and Shaddam both officially hold, seems like it's becoming outdated here on Earth. If my 5 seconds worth of Googling is any indication, Japan is the only country that still officially has an emperor. Uh-huh. So, Kevin asks, is there a work of science fiction where you saw how a civilization was governed and thought, yeah, I could totally see us becoming like this? Sincerely, Kevin.
Well, that's a very good question, Kevin. And this is why William Gibson has given up on science fiction prediction into the future, except for 1,000 years from now, because the next 50 or 100 years are going to be incredibly chaotic. And predicting the near-term future is a mug's game. But I will do it anyway. Distantly future could mean 1,000,000 years from now, or it could mean 1,000, or it could mean a lot of things. But I will answer your question in the spirit in which it was addressed. I have not read any particular piece of science fiction that encompasses what I think the future might look like. However, there are elements of Spider Robinson's Harmony that I admire a lot. There are elements of Robert Heinlein's Line Marriage, his setup on the moon, that have certain things going for it, including absolute equality of the sexes. I'm a believer in technology. I believe in the benevolent relationship between people and machines in the future, intelligent machines, because we are a lonely race. We have nobody to talk to. It's a big old universe. There's faster than light drive ain't coming anytime soon, which means we're stuck here. We have to cope with having basically the Earth as our home. The moon is a summer house. If we can ever get around to doing anything with Mars or Venus, that'd be great. But I don't see that happening in my lifetime. We can probably set up camp on some asteroids and harvest some minerals from them. But the near-term future of the human race is 9 billion people living on a planet not designed for 9 billion people, fighting over food and water and energy and so forth.
And livable climate, I would say. I mean, that's people are talking about climate refugees, which is very scary to think about. Yeah.
Well, and I can see a future where we have a shooting war nuclear shooting war in Africa over resources, over water. I can see a shooting war in the American Southwest over water. I can see millions of people dying for no reason other than there's not enough to go around, which means that any possible future that you can put the word civilization on and have it mean anything. And I'd see no reason, for example, that the Christian Catholic world couldn't slip right back into a dark age. I see no reason why Muslims couldn't become a profoundly advanced civilization leading the way as things were 1,000 years ago. I'm not saying that either of them are ideal, but every civilization, every religion has its ups and downs. And I don't see any reason why we couldn't have monarchies in the future. Frank Herbert did a lot of interesting writing about what happens when part of your species can live to be 1,000. William Gibson writes about the Villa Strelite, the people who live for multiple generations and are incredibly wealthy. So what happens when you have one strata of your society that commands 90% of all the wealth and can live as long as they want? They essentially become a different species and they rule over us. And
that's so close to happening. It's scary.
Yeah. And you have an inherently two-tiered system where they dictate and we follow because they own all the resources and they never die and they can protect themselves. So you essentially have a monarchy.
Yeah.
You have a true insect hive monarchy where you have one species, sort of, you know, you have one branch of the species that is the queen and everyone else. I don't like that future. I don't think that's necessary. I like the idea of a sort of highly distributed, somewhat anarchic future where basic human needs are met through machinery, through automation. That there's a story, I think, called The Anarchistic Colossus, where I don't remember much of it, but basic human needs were taken care of. So nobody's going to starve. Nobody's going to do without water. If you want more than that, if you want more than basic needs and basic shelter, it's on you.
Mm-hmm.
There are, I think the corporations stand a really good chance of running a substantial portion of our lives directly in the future.
Yeah.
But
let me interrupt you with a quote, and you tell me what book it's from. Let's see if you could do this.
All right.
And it's a quote from that goes along with this idea of corporations owning everything and running everything. First, what is it you want us to pay taxes for? Tell me what I get, and perhaps I'll buy it. Do you know what story that's from? What book that's from?
I have no idea.
Really?
It's probably Robert Heinlein, but
yes, it is.
It's probably,
how did you know that?
It's probably Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Annual O'Kelly says that in Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yeah. No, that Robert Heinlein. Well, Robert
Heinlein. How did you know that?
Because it had to be, if it's about taxes and fuck you, what do I get for my taxes?
Yeah. Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yeah. Well, the Moon is a Harsh Mistress. The flag of the moon is Tanstaffel. There is no such thing as a free lunch. It's a brutally capitalist society. It's a prison colony. Mm-hmm. That's a generational prison colony that's devoted to feeding the starving on Earth. They're growing wheat on the moon that they drop on the Earth to feed starving people. It's a wonderfully profitable business. It's a for-profit prison where you can never leave because there's no way out. And by the way, if you're there by the second generation, you're adapted to the moon and you die on Earth anyway. And it comes to pass that an intelligent machine awakens and joins forces with our ragtag band of blah, 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 and says, basically, we're all dead meat in about 20 years or 30 years. The resources will be gone. We're all going to starve to death unless we throw off this government. And they stage a revolution, and it's based on the American Revolution. And it's got a lot of, you know, Heinlein's favorite libertarian junk thrown in there. But Heinlein always cheated a little bit because his answer to the problems of a complex technological culture with a lot of bureaucracy was leave. And he even said the great thing about faster than light travel was you can leave. Well, sorry, but that's not going to happen. So since you can't go anywhere, since you're stuck in this particular orbit and with these particular people for the next 50 generations, then what do? Well, you have to have clean energy, and that means solar. That means fusion, hopefully at some point. And you have to have really adaptive, intelligent machines to help us clean up our messes and help us manage our affairs. And unfortunately, with those kind of tools can be used for incredibly bad reasons too. So I fully expect in my lifetime, or certainly, you know, in the next 50 years, to see a nuclear exchange somewhere on Earth. Probably not World War III, but somebody's going to light off a nuke or two or five somewhere, and it'll scare the shit out of us. And something will change in our basic view of governance. But I maintain a basically positive idea that human beings will be able to defeat the demons that drive us enough to establish a relatively stable culture out here on the third rock from the sun. Once we figure out how to cheap energy and how to not kill each other.
Yeah.
And the way to do that is make sure people aren't starving, make sure they're not dying of thirst, and make sure we all feel like we have a stake in our future.
And a say so.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree completely. Yeah. All right. I have one more question for you.
All right.
This is a great question from Christopher.
Bring it on, Christopher.
Test Drifty with this.
Mm-hmm.
In one of the Heinlein juveniles.
Oh.
He doesn't say which one, and I tried to Google it. I couldn't find it.
I'm praying that it was the one he wrote for Boy's Life.
Okay.
It's probably about scouting.
No.
Yeah.
I don't know. Uh-huh. In one of the Heinlein juveniles, mention was made of admiring fifth-order differential equations.
Jesus.
Okay. To what was the narrator referring?
I don't know. If I had to take a shot in the dark, it would be about cats or little girls who Heinlein found charming and interesting and delightful.
And somehow fifth-order differential equations are just as predictable as cats.
Well,
and
no,
little girl.
Or just as complicated.
Complicated.
And,
okay.
And cats don't give a shit what you think. Yeah. And, you know, and neither do children. They are interesting, complicated creatures who will tell you exactly what's on their mind. And so
but you're wrong.
Of course I am. It's about redheads, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if it's about redheads. Christopher's answer is the narrator was referring to certain portions of the female anatomy jiggling at low gravity.
Yeah, okay.
And Christopher says, bet he doesn't get it.
Yeah.
Oh, so yeah. Right. I wrote back to find he hasn't let me know what the name of the book is yet. But
well, Christopher, I will tell you this. In a story written during the late 60s, early 70s, a semicolon was used instead of a colon in a sentence that changed the entire meaning of that paragraph. Can you name the story and the author who misused the colon?
Thank
Sorry.
You, Glass.
That was a joke that fell really flat. You should edit that out.
I'll edit that out.
No. I will accept challenges regarding sentence fragments. I think I can get – it was Heinlein, obviously. I think I deserve at least partial credit for that. But you're right. You stumped me, Chris.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
So, Driftglass, Heinlein also published a list of sort of a syllabus of things that are essential life skills.
Yes. I do remember that. I have it on a needlepoint pillow somewhere.
No, you don't.
No.
Do you remember what the first one is? What's the first life lesson that, according to Heinlein, you're supposed to know how to do?
My memory doesn't work that way.
Oh.
I don't remember other than lyrics to David Bowie and Pink Floyd. I don't remember anything in actual linear order. I know that part of the list was you should be able to lead. You should be able to follow. You should be able to comfort the sick, I think, bury the dead, say a prayer. You should be able to lead a colony. You should be able to.
But what's the first thing you should know how to do?
I'm scattergunning this out. One of them was slaughter a hog, I think, or slaughter or dress an animal. Well, you know, survive on the front.
The first wonder of class is change a diaper.
Ah, yes. Of course it was. These were essentially, it was frontier survival skills plus mathematics.
And computer science. You're supposed to be able
program
to program a computer,
well,
too.
You know, yes. And it's that if you want to, it's sort of right action, right thought, right deed, right profession. It's a list of a decent person should be able to do these things. And they're frontier skills, mathematical skills, human being a decent neighbor, being a good leader.
But also being able to follow.
Being able to follow orders and take responsibility. But yeah, number one thing on the list that makes perfect sense, to change a diaper, because that is the number one thing.
She who changes the diaper rules the world. All right. We're done. Thank you.
Thank you, babe.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, Driftglass.
Happy Pi Day, Blue Gal.
And happy Pi Day. We are recording this on Pi Day, which is perfect.
And I got to fly.
Bye.